Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Liz McCormick. Today, we'll hear from two African-American women who are challenging stereotypes about Appalachia through their writing. We hear from poet Nikki Giovanni.
The white Americans in Appalachia, here in West Virginia, in these mountains, have been a friend to freedom. And I think that it's time we celebrate it.
And writer Crystal Wilkinson, one of the founding members of a group known as the Afro-Latchian Poets.
It's meant to be a story that makes someone's spine straight and makes them proud of who they are.
And we'll talk with a woman in West Virginia who set out to make a podcast that connects the people of Appalachia and those of the Arabic world.
I just would like to encourage greater curiosity and empathy towards people that we might not normally empathize with.
Challenging stereotypes about Appalachia and the way we interpret our own identity. Today on Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Liz McCormick, guest hosting this week's episode. What images or phrases come to mind when you hear the word Appalachia? Think back to the last time you saw an Appalachian portrayed on TV, in the national media, in a book, or a cartoon. Often when people talk about Appalachians, they portray us as white, or poor, or ignorant, or all three. But when you dig beneath the surface and challenge the stereotypes that are often used to misrepresent people who live in our region, the story becomes much more honest and interesting. There's a lot of diversity here, and that's where we begin today's show. Poet Nikki Giovanni has been challenging Appalachian stereotypes for decades. In the 60s and 70s, she helped lead the Black Arts Movement, who were a group of writers focused on encouraging a social and racial justice revolution through language and poetry. At the time, she was living in New York City. She later began writing children's books and poems about her memories back in Knoxville, where she was born. After living in New York, Giovanni returned to Appalachia in 1987 to live in Blacksburg and work at Virginia Tech. Back in 2015, I had the opportunity to meet Nikki Giovanni and speak with her about how she feels about the state of race relations in America today and why she fiercely defends Appalachians, especially our love of freedom. Giovanni started our conversation by reading her poem called Knoxville, Tennessee. It's about her grandparents' home in Knoxville, where she lived while she was a teenager.
I always liked summer best. You can eat fresh corn from Daddy's garden, and okra and greens and cabbage, and lots of barbecue and buttermilk and homemade ice cream at the church picnic, and listen to gospel music outside at the church homecoming, and go to the mountains with your grandmother, and go barefooted and be warm all the time, not only when you go to bed and sleep. I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, and I spent most of my summers with my grandmother, and then I actually moved in with my grandparents. So, yeah, I love this.
I love that poem, too. And can you talk a little bit about, in terms of Appalachia, how does this poem mean to you?
I just love it because, you know, there was always a garden. You always had something that your parents were growing. And I grew up being used to or having gardens. And, of course, I grew up also cooking with my grandmother. And grandmother would, you know, we'd go out and pick a tomato or go out and pick some peppers or, you know, we'd always have something that we were putting from the garden into the food that we were actually eating. So it always made sense to me. I don't do fast food. I know that whatever I do with the drive-thru in a car is not food, so I don't do that, you know.
And so we don't have your poem, When God Made Mountains, to recite, but could you talk a little bit about it? And if you remember any specific parts of it that stick out to you, if you could just talk a little bit about that poem.
Well, I'm actually a history major, so I've always been interested in how things evolve. And in thinking about West Virginia particularly, we cannot look at the history of the United States without recognizing the importance of West Virginia seceding from Virginia. The Civil War would have been an entirely different affair if the Union had lost control of these mountains, and we know that. And when God made mountains, I wanted to deal with why he was deciding to do that, aside from fresh water and stuff. He had to make a place, and of course you can't talk about the United States without talking about runaway slaves. And without these mountains, you know, this was the one place, West Virginia, that what became West Virginia, was the one place that a runaway slave, let's say you were coming up Alabama, you could come up and you could follow the water, and you could follow the water north. And in following the water north, you're going to get up here. These are going to be the people who are not going to turn you in. They're not going to turn you back. They're not going to sell you back. They're going to say, welcome. Actually, as you know, West Virginia is quite rich, and yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. Almost everybody in the world has benefited from the richness of this state, from its wood to its forest to its oil to any number of things that are here. And yet West Virginians have not benefited from that. We have taken that away. And I think that one of the things that the country doesn't like is the fact that West Virginia stood up for freedom when nobody else was standing up for freedom, when it wasn't of benefit for them to stand up for freedom. It was the right thing to do. And I think the country's been upset with West Virginia ever since, frankly speaking.
What was the initial kind of push for you to decide to express yourself through poetry in your what you stand for, in your activism, and just expressing yourself? Why was it poetry that you chose?
I really don't know. It's just all I really know is what I dream and what I think. And, of course, people of my generation, we all, you know, picketed it, and we did the things that one should do. And that was a good thing to do. But I also just had these dreams, and I wanted to share them, and I had these ideas. And I kept thinking, something is missing. We have a bastardized history of West Virginia that has to be corrected. And it's time that West Virginians realize that we can't let other people say what our history is. We have to look at what it is. And I know the same thing is true of Black Americans, that we can't just look at what was done to us. We have to look at and what good came out of this. And so as we look at America, we have to look at what is marginalized and figure out what and who has been marginalized and how and why that happens.
What are some of your observations of race relations and civil rights in the Appalachian region compared to the rest of the country? And if you can give some similarities and some contrasts.
I think historically, Appalachians have been friends to freedom. And I think we can show that. And we show it through some things that are really quite easy. We show it through the banjo, because the banjo is endemic to West Africa. And so the only way that anybody in Appalachia can play a banjo that knows the banjo is that Africans or those who were enslaved and escaping came up here. We know things like okra, you know, came from Africa. And of course, I live in Virginia. I teach at Virginia Tech. And Virginia prides itself on being the peanut capital of the world. Well, peanuts or West African. And so whatever Virginia has learned about peanuts, they learned that through the people they enslaved. So we have a communication, and the communication has been good. We can look at how we dress, and we can look at how we dance. I think that if I may, the white Americans in Appalachia, here in West Virginia, in these mountains, have been a friend to freedom. And I think that it's time we celebrate it.
Continuing with kind of the idea of with civil rights and activism and race relations, looking at today with kind of the things that have been going on, police brutality, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the debate over the Confederate flag, and much more. Can you share some of your thoughts on what's going on today in our country?
Well, clearly, some of it's sad. I have never understood the reason that policemen need guns. I still don't. And I, you know, the crooks will do whatever. But you don't need power and authority. Nobody does. And I have disliked the idea of policemen having guns because they already have authority. And somebody could call in and say, well, you know, Nikki, if the cops don't have guns, somebody will shoot them. But if the cops don't have guns, then the citizens will protect them. There's no question about that. And when we start to look at the inner cities particularly, we know, or we should know, that one of the things we want is we want the policemen or the police people, I should say, to have a partner. We know that we don't want just the white policemen to be out there, a couple of them, and then they're shooting people for no reason. Everybody's upset. We want a white and a black. We want a man and a woman. We want a continual mix of who these people are. And as I said, we want them to be without without guns. The Confederate flag is a segregationist flag. What is being called the Confederate flag came up actually as a response to the civil rights, which shows both stupidity about who we are as a nation and who we are as a people. If I had my way, starting first grade, I'm sure first grade, every American child would learn another language. And I think that every American child, and I'm just not trying to speak for the world, but I think that every American child should know how to swim. It's just something that we should make sure that every kid in America, and I don't know if we have to even wait till first grade for that one, you know, and we need to get those kids there to teach them how to swim, because these are skills. I would like to see every American kid starting kindergarten, first grade, play some sort of instrument. I think it'd be great, and whatever instrument they want, whether it's a piano, whether it's a saxophone, it doesn't matter. And in a generation, we would have an American child that could go any place on earth and be at home.
Do you think, compared to when you started in the civil rights movement back in the 60s, how do you feel about of today, what's going on today, to what you were working on back then?
Life is always about the going forward. And I think that I grew up in segregation. And it was really, I had to laugh. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, I don't know now, 5 years ago, some, you know, it's been a while. And I was invited to speak at the Tennessean Theater, which is there on Gay Street. And it's now historic. But it was so wonderful because I remember when I wasn't during the era of segregation, you weren't allowed. But you can't compare what we did 100 years ago, what we did 50 years ago, and how we're doing it. You have to say, are we engaged in the questions of our time? And are we working, if not to the best of our ability, to some of our ability to try to solve it? Mm-hmm. I think that has to be dealt with. I'm a big fan of Black Lives Matter, because a lot of people have been casual about Black lives. So one lady up in Connecticut said white lives matter too, but nobody said that it didn't. The we've been casual about what happens with Black kids and with Black people. We can look at our prisons and see we have just too many people in prison. And the thing that makes America, and I don't think we're great now, but I think we are on the cusp of a greatness. The thing that makes us potentially great is that we are allowing human freedom. Mm-hmm. That we are in 21st century, we're saying, yeah, you should be able to make some decisions about your life, and I should step back as long as you are a law-abiding citizen. You have a right to live your life. And it's so basic. It has nothing to do with what other people think, because when other people don't like it, they don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
In your speech at Shepherd University, you had mentioned Appalachian happiness is very important. And I wanted to ask you to explore that a little bit more and tell me why you feel that way.
Well, the thing that I admire, I don't know if the term is going to be most, but certainly way at the top of my list, is I admire the fact that you stand for freedom. And I admire the fact that we in Appalachia, and I'm going to include myself in that, have a concept of enough. And that's a concept that we are going to have to actually be able to share and spread across this country, because right now nobody has an idea of enough, which is why people are really being crazy to say, I want to be a billionaire. But actually, $1 million is enough, mm-hmm. maybe even something lower than that. But we in Appalachia have an idea of enough, mm-hmm. that this is... I'm satisfied. I'm pleased. I have a family. I have a decent house. I'm warm. You know, whatever it is, we have a concept of enough. And that idea that Appalachia brings to us, and Appalachia brings it to our country, that idea is what has to permeate. It has to permeate America.
And I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this already, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Do you feel like you're an Appalachian?
Well, I'm a Knoxvillian by birth, so yes, I am. I don't have any problem with being an Appalachian, but I'm also an American, and I'm also an earthling. And when we look at West Virginia, we are also looking at the future, because almost everything that has to do with space has come from people from this state. And I think that, again, sitting in at night in the dark sky watching it, you know, this is where the dreams come from. And so our rocket people, I mean, you can look at how many of our rocket people are West Virginians who have come from here. They said, well, some want to be an engineer, some want to be poets. You need both. If we're going to go to Mars, you're going to need both.
Again, that was poet, activist, and children's book author Nikki Giovanni speaking with me in 2015. She teaches at Virginia Tech and lives in Blacksburg, Virginia. Giovanni's writing and activism across the country and here in Appalachia began in the 1960s, helping give voice to some of the people who are often left out in conversations about our region. Next, we're going to hear from a woman who is continuing that work, along with a group of writers who call themselves the Afro-Latchian Poets. Crystal Wilkinson grew up in Kentucky with her grandparents. I spoke with her a few weeks ago about her experience of being Black in Appalachia and how it's influenced her passion to write. I asked Wilkinson to read one of her short stories from her first book called Blackberries, Blackberries. This short story is called The Wanderer.
Many a night, Javeda would lie on her back and be lulled by katydids and whippoorwills speaking to one another in the pitch of the Casey Creek night. A cool breeze would rustle her nightgown, and she would lie still and awake, paying close attention to the quiet of the darkness, the leaves rustling in the air like a woman's skirt tail, the dampness of the night, the chirping of a far-off bird. She'd make hand puppet shadows on the yellowed wallpaper as the moon shined its fullness into her bedroom window. Sometimes, with her nose pressed against a mason jar full of lightning bugs, Javeda would watch the blue-green fluorescent off and on glow and set to thinking. She would wonder why white folks seem to have life so easy and why Black folks seem to have so many stumbling blocks. After all, as Granny Teen said, we was traveling through the exact same life as them. Sometimes she even wondered what it'd be like if she rose up in the morning a white girl like Paula, who lived at the end of the gravel road, all fragile-like with bone-straight hair, jet black like Brownie's mane and tail, like some fragile China doll, spending her time sitting somewhere just looking pretty with people, both grown and children, making a fool over her. And that hair she got, all straight and easy, on a comb. Javeda wondered how Paula feel wedged between the sturdy legs of her grandnan or granny teen while her locks were being coaxed into behaving. Javeda guessed the flip side of that coin was that maybe, just maybe, Paula would never know the love that comes out of them hour-long combing spells, be it grandnan or mama or granny teen who was doing the combing. That's how Javeda got to the heart of all her womenfolk. That's where souls got transferred. That's where knowledge was passed on. She liked that time between sturdy black legs feeling the love being greased into her scalp. And what kind of patience could a 15-minute hair combing learn you anyhow? Javeda guessed if she didn't wake up black as pitch every morning that maybe, just maybe, there wouldn't be no need to be digging that deep all the way down to the soul for strength. She figured that if her skin wasn't blue-black, she'd have to learn to laugh from her mouth and not from her belly. Javeda decided that she wasn't even sure if she'd appreciate the beans and turnips on the table if she didn't help pick them for herself. And Granny Teen and Grandnan always said that a girl who won't work don't deserve no good, hard-working man. Finally decided that every morning God blessed her with she'd wake up black, so she'd have to learn to deal with it, everything that came with it. After her long spell of mind wandering, she'd roll over in her bed, bid the lightning bugs good night, and try to be thankful for being black as the sky.
What was the message you really wanted to convey in that particular short story?
Wow, it's been so long since I wrote that, and it's a piece that I rarely read, so I'm glad that you asked me to read it. Well, the whole collection, I have to talk about the collection overall, is about African-American women in Appalachia. and learning to be proud of who they are if they weren't already. So each story focuses in on Black women's lives in Appalachia. And so what I was trying to do was sort of make the invisible visible. It happens all the time. The Appalachian stereotypes are rampant throughout the country. And then I think if you're African-American on top of that, people don't think we exist. It happens all the time, no matter where I'm at in the world. And I tell people I'm from Appalachia, and they go, "What? Really? Are you? You're from Appalachia? I didn't realize that there were Black people in Appalachia." So it's meant to be a story that makes someone's spine straight and makes them proud of who they are.
In looking at all of your writing, is that sort of why you started to write as an Appalachian writer, to sort of drive that message?
Yes. I mean, I think in the end, that was the reason why I write. I think in the beginning, it was just sort of a calling. You know, I could almost compare it to being called to preach or called to be a musician. I've just always been a writer since I was a child. And before I started dealing with more complicated themes, I was just writing because I thought I had to. And in fact, at the beginning of my writing, I wasn't writing about Appalachia at all. I was just writing, really trying to write about New York, places that I hadn't been as a child. So it was always thinking outward during those early years. And then after I went to college and I began to think about where I'm from, and no longer in a shameful way of being ashamed of being country, is what we called ourselves, then I began to explore the wonder and the magnificence of being from Appalachia, and began to use those themes in a particular way.
How do you feel the world's perception of Appalachia is these days? And do you feel like the stereotypes are having less of an impact?
Well, I think the image is harmful. It's amazing to me. I was doing some math and realized that I've been a part of the Appalachian poets for almost 30 years now. And so we've been doing this work for almost 30 years. Appalachian Studies Association and all these other organizations have done work for even longer. Like, we've all been working so hard to combat stereotypes of Appalachia. And then it's disheartening somewhat to find that they still exist, that people still think of the region only as one in one particular way, and they think of it as negatively. And any sort of Appalachian stereotype that you can think of, there are people in other regions of the country that still think of us that way. So it's painful, and I feel like we're all sort of still having to preach the gospel. I'm hoping that at some point we won't have to, but we still have a lot of work to do toward that.
And kind of looking at tackling those challenges of stereotypes, what are some ways that we can do that in terms of celebrating Appalachia?
Well, I think just continue to tell our stories to show the world our humanity, because that's what it's about. Like, when you place someone in a category of a stereotype, you're not seeing people as real human beings with complexity and originality and humanity. So keep putting our stories out in various ways, whatever those individual stories are. I think we'll continue to show the diversity of the region. You know, we're all very tight-knit, but it's not one monolithic, one-eyed view of the world, and that we are very rich, very diverse, very complex, and filled with humanity and love.
That was author Crystal Wilkinson, who grew up in Kentucky and is one of the founding members of a group of African-American writers called the Afro-Latchian Poets. Wilkinson was this year's Appalachian Heritage Writer-in-Residence at Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Up next, we'll hear why a young woman in West Virginia created a podcast that explores the similarities between Appalachians and the Arabic world. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Liz McCormick. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia,
with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping farmers share their food with your family every week at your local farmers market. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
People on the outside looking in often misunderstand Appalachia's cultural traditions. Since the earliest days of settlement, people from cities have thought of Appalachians as less than, or different, or other. But those same attitudes are often leveled at people who live in the Middle East. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, spoke with a woman in West Virginia who set out to make a podcast that connects the people of Appalachia and those of the Arabic world.
Clara Hazlett grew up on a small homestead farm in Bethany, West Virginia, in the Northern Panhandle. She is one of seven children. She was homeschooled, and her parents gave her opportunities to explore culture and languages. She spent part of her early life after high school studying Spanish while traveling in Latin America.
I grew up being encouraged to learn and experience the world through an inquisitive lens. And I really was inspired to continue language learning and especially was attracted to the Arab world.
Like many people, the attacks on September 11, 2001 informed Clara's attitude toward the Arab world. She addresses that in the podcast.
When men in turbans showed up on my TV screen in the early 2000s, I was horrified.
Anybody know what that smoke is in Lower Manhattan?
Another one just hit the building.
Wow.
And I would shut my eyes, but I could still hear the AK-47s and the Allahu Akbars.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Despite that, when the opportunity came to study abroad in Morocco, Bahrain, and Jordan, she jumped at the chance. Those experiences opened her eyes to different cultures, but she saw similarities to the way she was raised as well. She decided to create a podcast to describe her own travels while giving a voice to the people she met along the way.
My name's Clara, and this is Sandstone. Sandstone is a storytelling podcast that seeks to understand the nuanced worlds of Arabia and Appalachia, and the people that call these places home.
That's the introduction to the podcast. She decided to call it sandstone because the rock type is common in both places. Sandstone is basic, but it can also be transformed into something greater than itself. Much like her own transformation, she says. For her, the podcast is about creating a greater understanding between the people she grew up with and the people she has come to call friends.
I just would like to encourage greater curiosity and empathy towards people that we might not normally empathize with, especially as we interact with refugee populations and watch the news and seeing an Arab or a Middle Eastern portrayed and being able to greater understand where they're coming from.
Clara explained that she hopes her friends in Appalachia and the Middle East will learn about each other by listening. She doesn't expect it to change the world, but she hopes it might open some listeners' minds.
It's geared primarily toward fellow West Virginians, but also people from the region who maybe don't know a lot about the Middle East and maybe don't really care too much about the Middle East. But through storytelling, I hope to inspire kind of a deeper understanding of that culture and world.
Clara says that while West Virginia is largely white and mostly Christian, it doesn't mean there aren't other cultures and perspectives here. We just have to pay attention.
As Appalachians and West Virginians, we're not interacting with diversity on a day-to-day basis. I think it's important to be experiencing other people and belief systems because it makes us reflective of our own belief systems and also allows us to empathize with people that we wouldn't normally empathize with.
For many people in Appalachia, the differences in culture revolve around differences in faith. The Middle East is primarily, but not exclusively, Muslim. Appalachia is primarily, but not exclusively, Christian. She interviewed a man from Alabama who is now an imam in a mosque in Morgantown, West Virginia. His name is Kip.
Right after 9/11, there was definitely this fear of Muslims as violent people. And the Muslims in America have done a lot to show that that's not the case. But what worries me is that that hasn't made people like Muslims anymore. Maybe you think the Amish people are weird, maybe, right? But you let them do their thing. You don't tell them they have to drive cars or whatever, right? You let them stick to themselves and live their way of life the way they want to, as long as they don't, you know, bother anybody else.
She also talked to an evangelical Christian with experience in the Middle East. His name is Pastor Joseph Cumming.
There are texts in the Quran that can be interpreted to support peace and love for your neighbor, to support war and violence. The same is true of the Bible. I'm a Christian. Of course I believe the Bible teaches peace, but I can find you abundant examples of evangelical Christian leaders quoting Jesus as saying, "I come not to bring peace, but a sword," in order to endorse war in the name of Jesus.
That's just one example of the misconceptions identified in the podcast. Clara will graduate from West Virginia University in December. She plans 4 more episodes in the Sandstone podcast, but has also applied for a grant to continue her studies in Jordan. If she receives that grant, she plans a 2nd season of Sandstone as a live, immersive event during her travels. Sandstone is available through Apple Podcasts and wherever you find your podcast. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas.
If you're interested in learning more about some of the similarities between Appalachia and the Arabic world, we've posted a story on our website about why geologists believe the Appalachian Mountains are related to a sister mountain range in Morocco, and how the cultures of our mountain people have some surprising similarities. That's at wvpublic.org. So we just heard from a podcaster, and before that, 2 writers, who were challenging stereotypes and misrepresentations about Appalachians. Next, we're going to hear about a musician who in some ways tried his whole life to be understood. West Virginia-raised musician and artist Daniel Johnston played a style of music that was entirely his own. He died last month at the age of 58. Known best for his earnest and harrowing lo-fi pop songs, Johnston remained an underground hero for most of his life. His influence, though, continues to stretch across musical and artistic genres and around the world. Dave Mistich brings us this tribute.
Do you hear the frog?
Huh? How are you?
Whether you've heard of Daniel Johnston or not, here's a quick warning. There's really no way to fully condense his life and work and do just a few minutes worth of radio. There are full-length documentaries for that, films that show a brilliant yet tortured person. There are flashes of genius, interspersed with dark stories about psychotic episodes, bad hallucinogenic trips, and unrequited love. In the backdrop, of course, are songs that have inspired countless people. I had the pleasure of speaking to Johnston by phone once, in 2011, for a piece I was writing for the West Virginia-focused alternative magazine Graffiti. He told me about growing up in New Cumberland, in Hancock County, and even as a teenager, he felt a struggle to find acceptance while being himself.
When I was young, there was no bands that would play that didn't play top 40 music, you know. There weren't any new music, original music bands. And I had bought a synthesizer and I had an organ and an electric piano trying to get into one of those bands. And I knew Freebird, but I didn't quite make it into these bands all the time.
But that early rejection didn't stop Johnston from dedicating himself to the craft of songwriting. He obsessively recorded nearly every idea he had.
If I met anybody or thought somebody was interested, I'd go home and make up a tape for them, and that's what I did forever. I really felt like I was a star for some reason, because my friends liked the tape so much, and we always had a party, and we'd pretend that we were like on David Letterman and interview each other, you know. So we were a bunch of crazy people.
Johnston made those recordings at his parents' home. In 1981, he released his first proper album, Songs of Pain, a cacophony of found sounds, piano, and Johnston's voice emitting a wavering yet calculated stream of consciousness.
If I had my own way, you'd be with me here today. But I rarely have my own way. I guess that's why you're not here with me today.
Johnston's impact stretches far and wide. Countless musicians have cited him as an inspiration. To be sure, some of Johnston's work has rubbed off on those who grew up in West Virginia, including one man, folk punk dynamo Jay Marinelli, originally from Morgantown.
For me, I think that he was really the first musician that I ever got into that kind of showed me that, like, at the end of the day, it's the song and just the delivery of the song matters, you know, infinitely more than, you know, how the song is produced or whether or not it is done in the quote-unquote right way.
Marinelli points to the song Wild West Virginia as being a key connection between Johnston, his home state, and genius-level songwriting.
It's, you know, it should be as associated with the state of West Virginia as that damn John Denver song. Which is also great, don't get me wrong, but, you know, the first time I ever heard that, I was just like, wow, he really got it, you know, crooked politicians, crater bum roads, you know, all that stuff.
I got a backwoods woman, underpants mama, farmer in the dale, crooked politicians, crater bum roads.
When I spoke to Johnston 8 years ago, he told me his fantasy was to attain the same level of fame as the Beatles. He acknowledged his passionate fans who applauded wildly when he would take the stage or finish a song. Even so, he was always aiming for something bigger.
I'm famous, but still not on the cover of Rolling Stone yet, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I'm not that popular as far as, like, big time, but that's what I want to try.
Johnston's face never did make it on the cover of Rolling Stone while he was alive. The magazine did report on him from time to time and did offer an obituary upon news of his passing. More importantly, Johnston did have legions of fans, millions of people who saw the beauty in the simplicity of his songs. A lot has been written about Johnston's struggles with mental illness. It's impossible to find a story that doesn't mention that part of his life. But what made Daniel Johnston so great, at least in my mind, had nothing to do with mental illness. In fact, his greatness was in spite of it. He was earnest and warm, awkward and unpolished, but ultimately sincere. Daniel Johnston saw the world for what it truly was, people just wanting to feel loved and accepted. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Dave Mistich.
Daniel Johnston sought to convey his own experience through words and music, which is something I think all Appalachian artists, writers, and musicians strive to do, to challenge how the rest of the world sees them, to say we are here and we are more than how the world thinks of us. Today, we've heard stories about people challenging stereotypes of what and who is Appalachian. We've also heard about how it can sometimes be a struggle to find acceptance in this region we call home. Overgeneralizing about who we are as Appalachians affects people in a personal way, especially if the narrative clashes with how we see ourselves. For our last story, we're going to hear about a woman who defies several stereotypes about Appalachians. Trailblazing international boxer and gay rights advocate Christy Salters grew up in Wyoming County, in the heart of West Virginia's coalfields. In addition to her career as a renowned boxer, she's also become an advocate for survivors of domestic abuse, something Salters experienced personally. Salters sat down with Emily Allen to share her story And just a note of caution, this story includes details about domestic violence.
Fighting out of Orlando, Florida, by way of Mullins, West Virginia.
It's 1996. We're in Las Vegas. Christy Martin is in the ring fighting the Irish boxer Deirdre Gogarty.
Ladies and gentlemen, recognized as the women's pound-for-pound champion, introducing the coal miner's daughter, Christy Martin.
In about a week, news organizations will report millions of households worldwide are tuned in to this moment as Christy Martin wins the six-round match.
The only thing that will stop her is the bell.
24 years later, Christy, who now goes by the name Christy Salters, remains a pioneer in women's boxing. But she's also raising awareness about domestic abuse and gay rights in the U.S. That includes her home state of West Virginia. Christy recently spoke at the 10th anniversary gala for Fairness West Virginia, a civil rights group for LGBTQIA+ West Virginians. We spoke in a small room off to the side while everyone got situated for the evening. Growing up in Wyoming County, Christy says she never imagined she would become a professional fighter.
My dad watched boxing a little bit in the 70s, late 70s, 80s, a little. I would watch the fights with my dad, but I never grew up thinking this is what I want to be.
One of her first competitions was the Mean Mountaineer in Beckley. She says she entered for fun and ultimately won two of the three fights by knockout.
I had never seen another woman fight when I fought. And that goes back to even in the Tough Man contest. They had never allowed women to fight in those here in West Virginia. Now women are boxing in the Olympics. Clarissa Shield has won two gold medals. We've had Katie Taylor, also is a gold medal winner from Ireland, that's getting big exposure now as a professional. It's changed a lot.
Christy moved to Tennessee after graduating in 1990 from Concord University, which was Concord College at the time. She signed with promoter Don King shortly thereafter. It was also in the early 90s that Christy married her trainer, Jim Martin.
And for 20 years, he used my sexuality like as a blackmail tool. I was up front with him from the beginning. I told him about past relationships I had had. He was like, he was fine, you know. But then as time went on, he would tell me, I'm going to tell the world you're lesbian. I'm going to out you. I'm going to tell your family.
Despite the paradise it looked like she was living on TV, Christy says her life was terrible.
There were times when I can remember just being in Las Vegas and walking through a casino and thinking, wow, how awesome would it be to be with someone that I love, sharing these really, really cool experiences that I'm having and sharing them with somebody that I love and that loved me. He didn't love me. I was his ATM. I was his personal ATM. I was just his money machine. So finally, I just got tired. I didn't care anymore. And I left.
She left Martin in 2010. That November, she says he tried to kill her.
He stabbed me repeatedly, punctured my lung, cut my calf muscle almost completely from my leg, shot me. Left me what he thought was dead on the floor. But God had another plan, and I was able to get up and get out.
Today, Martin is in prison for attempted murder. Christy divorced him, and today she speaks on behalf of women and children in domestic abuse situations. A few years ago, she married her wife, fellow boxer Lisa Hollowine.
Today, I would give anything to be the person I am today, to have been this person throughout my boxing career. Yeah, I mean, I'm married to Lisa Hollowine, and, you know, we're gay wherever we are.
Christy says giving back to her home state is important to her.
I didn't have anybody growing up like I could that I knew that was gay, and I could, you know, go talk to them and ask them, what do I do? How do I do this? Can you talk to my mom, you know? And just for parents to understand that it's not the end of the world, and it's not about you. But, you know, so many, we have this, what is he, a representative, senator, or whatever, that basically threatened to drown his, he says he's a Christian, but threatened to drown his children if they were gay?
Christie confirmed she's speaking about Eric Porterfield, a West Virginia House delegate from Mercer County, and comments he made in the 2019 legislative session.
Yeah, I mean, you're not a Christian and you make veiled threats to drown your children. You know, I'm embarrassed for him, but I'm embarrassed for me and my state because people, you know, outside of West Virginia already look down on us and think that we're behind and we're not smart and all this negativity. And for him to come out and say something like that, I mean, it feeds into the stereotype that West Virginia has.
In reality, Christie says, West Virginia is moving in the right direction.
I'm proud to be here. Just to be at an event like this is huge. And it is changing. Even in my small town, Mullins and you know, Wyoming County, it is changing. People are becoming more accepting of other people. And look, what I'm doing doesn't in any way affect what you're doing. So, and this is the way I see it. I'm the same person I was before you knew I was gay. So if you loved me before, are you going to tell me you don't love me now because you know I'm gay? I mean, it makes no sense. I'm still the same person.
While Christie is no longer in the ring, she's still fighting to raise awareness for survivors of emotional and physical abuse. She says she looks forward to helping facilitate more inclusive communities with groups like Fairness West Virginia. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
Emily is a Report for America Corps member. She reports on stories in rural West Virginia. This week, we heard from Appalachian writers, advocates, a podcaster, a musician, and a boxer, who all challenge the stereotypes and images the world sees as Appalachian. Our region is truly diverse and can't fit into a single box. But those stereotypes about Appalachia may always be around, despite our best efforts to counter them. Though if given the chance and folks take a closer look, they'll be surprised by what they find here. A proud region that has dealt with tough economic times and battles of identity, and a region that fights for itself and celebrates its culture. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WFPL. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackfert, Dinosaur Burps, and Spencer Elliott. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Liz McCormick. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.